The following program is a presentation of the FlyPod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
FlyPod.com. I'm Mark DeWitt. Welcome to Cover to Cover. Well, we have the author of her second book. It's titled Little Fires Everywhere. This is a novel by Celeste King. Celeste, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, now this book, Little Fires Everywhere, it opens up with little fires everywhere, pretty much in a house.
That's right. It opens up with the Richardson family finding out that their house is burning to the ground right on the first page.
And pretty much we find a little bit out about the characters in the book, the Richardson family. And as we move through the book itself, we find out that Izzy, she's a little different than the other family members.
Yeah, so Izzy is the youngest child of the family. There are four Richardson teenagers, and Izzy is always sort of the black sheep. She's the kind of rebel in the family. She's the troublemaker, and we find out that she's the one who's sort of been causing trouble along, and that she's the one who's burned the house down.
And we also have little Pearl. Tell me about Pearl and her mother.
So the Richardson family is sort of well established in the community, Shaker Heights, which is my own real life hometown. And this mother-daughter pair from out of town come in, Mia Warren and her daughter Pearl, who's 15. And they rent a house from the Richardsons, and two families are sort of drawn together. Pearl is really drawn towards the Richardson kids and their mother, Mrs. Richardson, and the Richardson kids are drawn towards Mia and Pearl. It's sort of opposites attract kind of situation.
Now, Pearl's mother, an artist, if you will.
Yes, she does a lot with photography, but she doesn't consider herself to be a photographer. She takes pictures, and then she kind of manipulates them in ways to sort of make them into collages. She paints them, she cuts them up, she does all sorts of things, and she and Pearl move around from town to town. Whenever Mia needs new inspiration, they pack up into their Volkswagen. They really don't own a lot, and they just drive to a new place. And this is the first time that Mia has said that they're going to stay put.
Pearl doesn't really know her father. Her father's not in the picture.
Right. She's been raised by Mia as a single mother. She's never had a father in the picture. And of course, the question of who Pearl is, where she came from, who her father is one of the big mysteries of the book.
How much research maybe did you have to do on children without parents and maybe problems that they've had through life, along with maybe this almost sounds like an army brat where they're always moving, but of course her mother is a artist.
Right. I thought about that actually a little bit on that comparison to being an army brat, having known kids whose parents were either in the service or who had jobs that just took them around, and how different their sort of experience was, that their experience was really sort of rooted in their family, wherever their family happened to be, versus somebody who'd been born somewhere and stayed there their whole life. You know, you have the house that you grew up in. I think it's just a different way of relating to the world. So I read a little bit about that, and I also sort of read about children who are adopted, children who have sort of different family structures. One of the subplots in the book deals with a transracial adoption, and so I read about sort of the history of that in the United States and some of the important court cases.
So I guess somebody listening might say, well, the book title is Little Fires Everywhere. Maybe it just doesn't have to do with physical fires.
Well, yeah, so there are real fires, but there are also, of course, the metaphorical fires, which is that all of the sort of trouble that comes to a head when Mia and Pearl come to town and meet the Richardson family, of course, all of those fires have been sort of, brewing under the surface, so to speak. They're just the thing that brings it out.
When you're unable as a child really to stay at the same school, at the same neighborhood, always having different friends, Does that wear on your, maybe, intelligence from learning and everything, do you think? I know Pearl is not that way.
She's not. She's really precocious. I made her a little bit of a bookish kid, which is what I was as a kid, you know. So she's, I think her way of dealing with this is that she takes refuge in the books that she reads. You know, that's the world that she gets to bring with her and the friends that she can keep with her wherever she goes. I think it could go sort of two ways for you. One is that it could make you sort of very outgoing and very bold because you've got very little to risk, right? If you mess up, you'll just try again at the next town. Or it could make you sort of shy. And in Pearl's case, it makes her sort of shy. And so she's really excited to meet the four Richardson kids, one of whom is just her age, and kind of have stable friends for the first time.
A question I like to ask, and I know with Little Fires Everywhere, I'm in the Richardson home, I'm in that big fluffy couch, I might be fighting for that perfect spot right in front of the television set. How do you make things come alive? I mean, I can see that in my mind's eye.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that. Thank you. I mean, for me, that's one of the joys of writing, is sort of figuring out the exact right words to sort of put the right image or sensory detail into a reader's head. And so I think, you know, we tend to think a lot about sort of visual detail, and I use a lot of that, but I also try and just think about all of the senses, sort of, what does it smell like? What does it feel like? You know, what is the texture of that couch? What are the noises that you hear? All of that, I feel like, fleshes out the world for the reader. And that's part of my goal as the writer, is to make you feel like you're immersed in this world.
Well, with Little Fires Everywhere, you know, I've read some books where the descriptions will just wear on and on and on. And with this book, it wasn't like that, but you can actually see this comes to life. And you do want to turn the page, too. You just want to keep going.
Well, I'm a firm believer in beautiful language. I started off wanting to be a poet when I was a teenager and realized that I did not have what it took to be a poet. You know, I wasn't good enough, but I love having sort of the right descriptions, and I love lush language. But at the same time, I'm also a reader, and I really want, I want the story to keep you interested. I want you to keep turning the pages. And so I try and have every detail that's in there be in there for a reason. You know, if I'm telling you what the kids are eating or what they're doing or what sounds there are, it's all trying to create a mood to help the story along.
But not over-describing it.
No, I mean, I love, like I said, I love lush language, and I feel like, you know, there are places where you get language for language's sake, but I also really want every word that's in the story to matter.
As a poet, I mean, this is kind of interesting because that's music.
Yeah.
I mean, you put music to poetry, you have a hit song, I guess.
I think that's right. And I think that, although, as I said, I was sort of a failed poet, that attention to language really helps me now in my fiction writing, because I write by ear, really. As I'm writing, I'm kind of listening to the words in my head, and I'm often writing to a rhythm that I find later, and that's often how I know if I'm not getting it right. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't fall off your tongue, you get tripped up, something like that. And for me, it's really all about sort of how it sounds in your ear. That's how I know whether I need to break this sentence up into lots of short pieces, or if I need to have a dash for a pause, or if I need to have lots of ands to keep the sentence going. It's, you know, I'm not a musician myself, but that's the closest I can get to music, I think.
That's real interesting, because a lot of times, you know, you see musicians and you say, well, what was it, the music or was it the words first? And I think I hear everybody say that, and so that's interesting to hear that the words do have a rhythm.
Yeah, and it's, and I think there are people, I think, maybe who write maybe more cerebrally than I do, whereas for me, you know, it's always sort of about the music of the language. If it doesn't sound quite right to me, I have to go back and rewrite it. I'm not one of the writers who can kind of throw everything down on the page and then come back and fix it up later. I'm always tinkering as I go along, for better or for worse.
So starting out pretty much as a poet writing poetry, going to novels, what was the challenge with going from poetry to full-length novels?
Well, there were some intermediate stages in between. I have to admit that I started off as a poet, and I wrote some short stories, and I wrote what I called novels when I was about 14, which were really, you know, about 80 pages long, and didn't have a lot of plot to them, and, you know, we kind of rambled. One of the big challenges, I think, is that in poetry, you really want to kind of distill everything. You want it all to sort of be like a concentrate, you know, of this one moment or this one feeling. And in a short story and then in a novel, you have more space that you have to fill. But you don't want it to just be filler. In a way, you kind of want to expand on what you're doing. You want the story to feel full, even as it's longer than a couple of pages.
So how many times do you have to go back? I mean, you know, maybe you don't do it this way, but do you go from the beginning to the end? Do you have ideas for the middle, maybe the end, and write to that? And do you write maybe a chapter and then expand on it? How do you write a chapter?
It was different for both books, and I know different writers have different processes, and what I'm finding is that I was a different writer with each book that I was doing. With my first novel, I didn't know what I was doing. I had these characters, I had an idea of what was going to happen to them, but I didn't know how to put a book together. And so I did a lot of writing that never made it into the finished product. I did, you know, a lot of writing with characters and all these scenes that did not belong in the story, but that told me a lot about the characters. So I had, you know, 20 pages of a mother, you know, going to arrange her own mother's funeral. And in the final book, that's boiled down to about a page and a half. But so in the first book, I was writing piecemeal. I was sort of feeling my way around as if I were in the dark, figuring out what to do. And I didn't write the book in order. I didn't write the book in chronological order either. So a lot of my work was to piece it all back together. With Little Fires Everywhere, I set myself the goal of trying to write it in chronological order and trying to write it from the first chapter to the last. And I didn't quite do that, but I at least sort of had a through line that I was following, and then I could go back and patch up and shore up.
In movies, they do that. They start off, now, were you writing maybe, here we are in the Richardson house, and we're writing this. Oh, I like this too and this too. Or is your mind kind of like that, maybe, then you go maybe to someplace else in your writing, or
it's very associative for me. I'll start writing a scene. Basically, the way I get myself to work in the morning is I tell myself, okay, all you have to do is write this one scene. Just write the scene where Pearl comes to the Richardson house for the very first time, and I sort of give myself a pep talk and say, you can do that. It's just a scene. And I'll start doing that. And then as the characters come in, it's almost like I've got all of my little dolls in place and the story starts to grow. And I was like, okay, so they're going to do this. Well, they're going to be watching TV. Well, what are they going to be watching? Like, well, they're going to be watching Jerry Springer because it's the 90s. And, you know, and then the story goes in there. Are they going to be chit-chatting? And what are they going to talk about? And so the scene kind of grows from there. And I might not keep all that stuff where it is in the end, but it is maybe a little bit like you're talking about, where I'm like, oh, and ooh, and let's add some of that. Ooh, and let's go with that. Let's improv a little and see where that goes.
Now, let's kind of shift gears just a little bit. And what I think we'll do is talk about your first book, Everything I Never Told You. Find out about that. Get a little flavor of that. We'll come back to Little Fires Everywhere. Celeste will tell us a little bit about this story without giving anything away, because I sure don't want to do that. I mean, it's a great read, and I want you to enjoy it without giving anything away. So let's talk about Everything I Never Told You, your first book.
So as you said, it was my first novel. It takes place in 1977 in a small fictional town in Ohio. And it follows the Lee family, which is a mixed-race family. The father is a Chinese-American man. The mother is a white American woman from Virginia. And they have three biracial children. And when the novel opens, we find out at the very beginning that the middle child, Lydia, who is 16 and who is the favorite in the family, is not in her bed. And we soon find out that she's actually drowned in the local lake. And this sort of leads the family into a crisis point where they're trying to sort of understand, how did they get to this point? And also, are they going to be able to recover from that? And it's all sort of bound up in some family secrets and in, you know, things that the family sort of had kind of not worked out with itself. So that's the premise of the first novel. And it's really, for me, a story about a family trying to come to grips with the tragedy, and also an exploration of the ways that people understand each other, fail to understand each other, even when they're family, when they're the people who you think you're the closest to.
Now, I know it's a drowning of the little girl. Did the authorities in your book have to maybe go to the family, or maybe they thinking that the family could have done this?
They look into this. The a lot of the people in the novel sort of assume that it's a suicide. She's a very high-achieving she's a high-achieving teen, and they find out that sort of the life that she appeared to be living, where she seemed to be quite popular and doing well in school, is actually not quite what it had seemed to be, that she actually was, you know, struggling in a lot of different ways. But I really wanted to make it less of a whodunit sort of story and more of a story where the reader focused on the personal dynamics. That's always what draws me into any story, sort of how people respond to each other, how they act with each other, why they do the things that they do. I really wanted it to be sort of a psychological portrait of a family and of siblings, and then of the relationships between parents and teens.
Your first book, Everything I Never Told You, tell me a little bit about how that was published. I mean, you sent that off. Was it rejected? Was it picked up just like that?
I was really lucky in that I had some interest right away. So I had started writing the book when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan up in Ann Arbor. I had about the first two chapters, which were in a very different state than they are in the current book. The project changed a lot. And I ended up signing with an agent in New York, a literary agent. And when we finished the book, she sent it out to publishers, I think it was the Friday before Thanksgiving. By Monday and Tuesday, she was calling to say, okay, I've got some editors who've read the book. They're interested in it. We're going to set up some meetings. We had a sort of enforced break because of Thanksgiving, where I was so nervous that I did not really manage to eat any turkey at all. The following week, I talked to editors, and it ended up going to auction. So we had five publishing houses that bid on it. And I was really fortunate that that's sort of the dream scenario for publishing a book, especially a first book.
Yeah, that's what every author wants, but they don't always get that, I guess.
I was just incredibly, incredibly fortunate, and I still, honestly, every now and then I turn to my husband and I say, is it possible that I just imagined this, and that this is a very, very vivid hallucination? And he always says, well, it is technically possible, but he's like, I don't think that's the case.
Well, with the Little Fires Everywhere, your second novel, it's out right now in hardcover. Give me a little flavor of the story with this.
Sure. So, as I said, it takes place in Shaker Heights, which is my real-life hometown and a place that I loved growing up in. I still love it. It's a suburb on the east side of Cleveland, and it actually is one of the first planned communities in the United States. Everything about it is sort of very carefully thought out. From the layout of the streets to sort of the appearance of the houses to the school system. And the community prides itself on being very progressive, being very racially diverse, and being very idyllic. And it is. It's all three of those things. And that's actually why my parents chose to move there when we moved to Cleveland. And it follows the sort of intertwining of these two families. There's the Richardson family, who sort of embody the ethos of the town, that they believe in the rules, they believe in sort of doing good and of, you know, kind of order and all of those sorts of things and planning. And then there are the Warrens, Mia Warren and her daughter Pearl, who's the artist from out of town and her teenage daughter. And they come from out of town and they really kind of don't follow the same rules. They're outsiders in the town and they don't have the same roots that the Richardsons have. And these two families are sort of drawn together because they're so different from each other. And everything comes to a head when friends of the Richardsons adopt a Chinese-American baby that's been abandoned at a fire station. And this creates a custody battle when the biological mother comes back and wants her baby back. And Mia and Mrs. Richardson end up on different sides. And that leads them sort of into conflict, that really kind of leads them to dig up the secrets in each other's past, and everything ends in literal fires, yes.
You know, it's almost like a starving artist, if you will, moving to Shaker Heights, a well-to-do community in the Cleveland area. How do you come up with the dichotomy of that?
Well, having grown up in Shaker Heights, in sort of like a what I think of as a normal family-sized house, my family was middle class. You know, my mom was a college professor, my dad worked at NASA, so we had, you know, we had plenty to get by on, but we were definitely not wealthy. And I had friends who lived in really big houses. I had friends who lived in apartment buildings, and I also had aunts and uncles who lived in two-family houses in Shaker, which we called duplexes. And so I was kind of aware of those sort of class differences, and once I had moved away and I saw sort of different kinds of neighborhoods, what different cities were like, I realized how oddly Shaker Heights handles class. one of the examples I have in the book is that in these two family houses, they have to look like single family houses from the outside. They can only have one front door. They can only have one front door light. They can only have one mailbox. And the logic is that the city didn't want there to be a stigma for people who were living in a two-family house because, you know, they didn't own the whole house. Maybe they were just renters. But it's also a sort of weird thing to sort of paper over that difference and make everyone pretend that they live in a single-family house. So I was really interested in these ideas of class, and having these two families come together seemed like a good way of highlighting that.
You mentioned your father worked for NASA. I'm interested in that. Was he a rocket scientist?
He was a physicist. There's a research center on the west side of Cleveland. It used to be called NASA Lewis Research Center, and now I think it's called the John Glenn Research Center. They renamed it. But he was a physicist, and he worked with combustion, basically. And so my sister and I got to tease him if he ever, you know, made a mistake or couldn't program the VCR or couldn't program the microwave, that he's a literal rocket scientist, and yet you can't program the VCR, Dad.
So was he maybe working with the Gemini program? Was he working?
It was a little bit later. I am not sure of the details of what he was working on, but I think that research center, they sort of work on a lot of sort of components and techniques that then sort of get moved along to support the space missions.
Well, I bet he was pretty popular at your school when you had like a Father Day or something where they come in and talk about what they do.
Well, I was always sort of embarrassed when my parents came in because, you know, scientists there is come in and they're like, yes, science, we're going to talk. My mom actually, my mom is a chemist, and so she taught chemistry at the university, and she was actually always the one who came, volunteered to come into all the science classes and would give out periodic tables and talk to people and do chemistry demonstrations. And I was always going, Mom, can you not do that?
So, in school, were you great in chemistry and the sciences? I mean, my father worked as kind of an electrician with things, and that was awful in that.
I was good at science. I was, you know, I think my parents sort of taught me to think like a scientist in a lot of ways. So, it was never scary to me. I was never intimidated by it. I was good at math. But I was also really good at all of the sort of humanities, I guess. You know, we don't call them that in elementary school and high school. But I was a really early reader, and my parents were readers, too. And so our house was always crammed full of books. And I think it was obvious to everybody from very early on that that was where my passion lay, that it always lay with reading and writing stories.
I've been to Cleveland a few times. Of course, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think they call it Quaker Village, and it's not really the Quaker religion, but it's the Quaker Oats Man.
Oh, interesting. I actually don't know that one. I'm going to have to find out about that.
Yeah, the hotels are old silos.
Oh,
there's
fun.
A hotel that's an old silo, and the rooms are kind of roundish.
How fun.
Yeah, yeah. If you ever get a chance, that's really fun. Little Fires Everywhere, of course, your second book, Everything I Never Told You, your first book. What's coming up next?
Well, right now I'm in the middle of book tour, so I'm getting to go around and talk to readers, which is always sort of a really rewarding and also incredibly humbling experience for me. I'm really lucky as a writer to get to meet someone who's read my book. And then after that, I have to get started on another book. I've got a couple of ideas that are sort of slowly taking shape in my head. So the nice thing is that I'm now in the stage where I get to read a lot of new things. I get to read other people's books. I get to, you know, go to museums and learn about new stuff and sort of see what inspires me and what sparks a new story.
Reading other people's books, do you do that as you're writing?
I do, because there's nothing so inspiring as seeing other people writing books and going, wow, how did you do that? I really want to learn how to do that too. I feel like there's just a lot of really good writing out there, and seeing other people do really cool stuff makes me want to up my own game in a certain way. If I'm really actively drafting and I'm, you know, writing a few hours a day, sometimes I don't have the brain power to read, but I feel like writing and reading for me sort of feed each other, and so they're usually happening at the same time.
You mentioned earlier on with Little Fires Everywhere, you would work on the book. What is your schedule to work on a novel?
Well, with my first novel, I was sort of very precious about how I did it. And I would say, oh, I'm not inspired today. I'm going to do something else. Maybe I'll just read, you know. And then when I got inspired, I would write for maybe, you know, 5 or 6 hours at a stretch. I'd stay up till 3 in the morning. And now I have a little boy, so my schedule is much more regimented. So basically, when he goes to school, I go to my desk and I start working. And so I'm at least writing or editing or trying to write from about 9 until 3 o'clock when I have to go pick him up from school. And that's sort of what I learned, that if I don't try and write during that time period, writing doesn't happen. So that's when I have to make it happen.
You know, Celeste, with talking with you about your two books, I cannot imagine you even having writer's block.
I mean, I don't know if I believe in writer's block. I think a lot of times when we say that, it's just that we don't yet understand the stories that we're trying to tell. For me, writing is always the way that I figure things out. It's not that I figure it out and then I just write it down. It's always sort of the process of me working out what I'm thinking on the page. And so when I feel blocked, a lot of times it's just because I haven't thought enough about it, or I don't know enough yet to write the story. And so that's a cue to me that I need to read more. I need to go learn more. I need to think about it more. That's usually sort of how I look at blocks, because I definitely have times when the writing does not happen. I'm not at my desk every day, you know, happily typing away at my laptop. There are always slow parts. But for me, the thinking about writing as a process of understanding is sort of what kind of allows me to at least get a little bit done every day.
Are you consumed by the story, and when you're out shopping, you're just always thinking about it and everything you're thinking about it?
I really am. It's kind of embarrassing that I think writers often, we look like we're not working because we look like we're kind of daydreaming. And what's often happening is that we're sitting there and we're working out plot problems in our head, or we're watching people in the grocery store and we're sort of thinking, oh, that phrase is something that my character would say. I tend to have insomnia. And so a lot of times when I'm not sleeping, I'm lying there and I'm thinking about my plot problems and how I'm going to fix them.
You know, you're young enough that social media, big in this business, I'm sure, and that's probably helped you. I've heard of authors, and this goes back probably 80s and 90s, that they would go to book signings and not have a single soul. And, you know, maybe a lot of times you don't get a whole lot of people, maybe you get a huge amount, but I'm sure social media plays a lot into that.
I think it does. I feel like social media cannot make a book successful in and of itself, but I think it can really help in getting the word out. I wasn't really sure that I was going to like social media, and I was sort of, you know, nudged into doing it because that seemed like the thing to do. And I joined Twitter, and I actually now love Twitter. For me, because I work out of my house or out of the library, that's sort of like my office water cooler, where I get to go chit chat with people and we get to talk about, you know, what we watched on TV. And it's a nice sort of social interaction for me. And one thing that has been amazing is that people read my book and then they find me, and then we can have conversations on Twitter, and then they show up at my readings and they say, we know each other on Twitter. And it's nice because I feel like, oh, we do know each other. You know, it's, I'm surprised at how much I like it, but it's been a really wonderful part of the experience.
Well, let's make it a little easier to find you. Celeste, do you happen to have a website?
I do. It's easy to remember. It's my name, CelesteEng.com. So it's CelesteN, as in Nancy, G, as in George.com. On there is information about both of my books, book club guides, little extras, like there's a playlist for each of the books, you know, music the characters might listen to, things like that, all kinds of information.
Yeah, and you had a real neat interview with kind of a famous guy in New York, I guess.
I did yesterday. I got to meet Seth Meyers, which was fantastic. He was one of my my nerd heroes. But one of the things that I love about him is that he has a lot of writers on his show. He is a reader. I mean, he had really read my book, which is almost unheard of sometimes. You know, when you go on TV, they often don't have time. And I really admire that he has a lot of writers. He has a lot of women writers. He has a lot of people of color on there. And it's just clearly a book nerd like me.
Well, hopefully you have that little segment on your website.
It'll be up there soon. I think it's available on the NBC site and on YouTube now, and I'll be getting a link up to it, as well as links to, you know, audio interviews and all kinds of stuff.
The brand new book, Little Fires Everywhere by Celeste Eng. Man, this is a page-turner. It'd be a great book if you're in a warm climate right now, and it's warm just about anywhere anyway. Take it to the beach. Take it with you anywhere you go. It's a page-turner. You're going to want to know more about the Richardson family and Pearl and her mother. And are they going to leave Shaker Heights, or is this the town for them? Celeste, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Mark DeWitt for Cover to Cover.
access this or other audio programming, visit our website, theflypod.com.